Okay. Welcome everyone to this second part of this evening, Money and Morals, Copyright's Role for Creative Labor. My name is Andrea Götzke, and we have this wonderful panel with John Street, Ananay Aguilar, Med Professor, and Helen Smith. There was so much in the presentation already that I think I'm gonna actually can just leave lots of my introduction because there were so many points already raised. Over the next hour, we aim to discuss copyright from the perspective of artists today. So we kind of take on where the discussion just left off from the previous presentation and see what can copyright do these days for musicians, composers, producers, songwriters. Maybe not the Jay-Z's or the big ones, or we can talk about those as well, but about, you know, in musicians, like maybe some of you in the audience and in the broader sense of musicians in Europe. I think we'll talk mostly about the European context. What is the role and relevance of copyright for artists in the current environment? And also, I'd be interested to discuss how do artists conceive of copyright and how does it influence their practice? And I would like to start with a first round of introduction and already combine the introduction with the first question because we don't have so much time, so we can start gathering information on the topic already. And I would like to start with you, John Street. John Street, you're a political scientist at the University of East Anglia in the UK. Welcome. So you examine copyright from the perspective of political science, and you've written about like assumption that copyright is based on, but also kind of notions that copyright creates in our thinking and in like musicians' minds when they create. And I would be interested to know, which notions connected to copyright do you find important for the sake of this conversation? Like, what should we keep in mind?
Yes, as Anka said, my interest comes from the fact that I'm a political scientist, and typically political scientists haven't really taken much interest in copyright, haven't really looked at its importance to the way the world is organized, and actually I suspect it is more important than we have acknowledged in political terms. And you just start with that very first thought, which was that, you know, if you look at the regime of copyright that operates in China and you compare it with what operates in Western countries, you realize, you know, politics explains the difference. But it isn't just that kind of global politics that or national politics that seems to affect the way copyright operates and the way in which people produce music under the terms of that policy. But it's also operating at the very lower level. One of the things we did in our project was to actually go and interview musicians who sit, as we put it, on the digital margin, people who didn't really have much money coming from their musical creativity, but who had a very strong sense of what was fair, what was right, and what was just in the way in which copyright operated in relation to what they did and how they thought of their creative activities. And so you kind of see right from the national to the local, the ways in which political ideas of justice and fairness, rights, integrity and so on play into copyright and are determined by political decisions by national governments, supranational governments like the EU, determine the kind of conditions under which music is made. And those policies and the debates that take place in the European Parliament and elsewhere seem to have a profound effect on the way in which copyright operates and therefore the kind of music that gets made and the kind of things, issues that Aaron was raising about how the internet is going to be regulated, and whether it's going to be regulated also affect, as he pointed out, the kind of music we get to share and the culture we enjoy. So it seemed to me that politics was a very important part, both politics as, you know, real politics of power, but also politics of ideas and ideology.
All right. we pick up on what everybody said in the discussion. Let's continue the round of introduction with Ananay Aguilar. You're a musicologist at the University of Cambridge in the UK also, and you are also a consultant to the International Federation of Musicians, but you're here as an, you participate in this panel as you, as an independent researcher. So you have worked, or you have run a research project that was specifically on performers' rights. And so thinking about musicians, I'm curious to learn from you, when it comes to copyright, what's the difference between a performer and a composer? And what are some of the key issues that you have identified, like in your research project? If that's not too much, like if you can.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Authors and performers. As Aram was talking just now, there's a very clear idea of what authors are and what their contribution is to the music and the score and performers are in a different place from that. Performers don't do the thinking in music. That's how they are treated, and this is how it is conceived sort of traditionally. Yes, I have looked at it in the sense of sort of philosophies of mind over body and how this translates into copyright law. And you see it, how copyright has developed and how industry practice also favors authors and et cetera, all over the place in management and in reform and everything. Authors normally get privileged. Mm-hmm. So I question that in my work and look at contributions of performers.
Could you maybe give an example just to understand where, for example, that differentiation wouldn't make so much sense, or so that we can understand, like how a performer, like what's the contribution of performers to music?
So, for instance, I've looked at how people conceive about their own work in order to think about how you share your rights between musicians. So there are very different ways of sharing your rights, and some stand up in court, some don't, but there are still different agreements between musicians. And in classical music, it is very clear, the person who writes the score is the author. And I have talked to contemporary musicians who have maybe worked with the composer, who have looked at the score with the composer and contributed and said, well, this doesn't work, or how about this sound, and et cetera. That, even in that working relation, the assumption is the person writing the score is the composer, therefore the author, and the person with the instrument is the performer. In pop music, that's not the case. And you have something called Nashville style, for instance, composition, everybody in the same room, everybody contributes, whatever contribution that is. So it's about, that can be playing, that can be producing, that can be bits of the lyrics, it can be anything. Mm-hmm. And everything counts, and everybody gets the same share. Mm-hmm. And the agreement is we're all composers, if you like. We are all part of, so it's about different origin stories. Mm. Like, and it is socially mediated, not necessarily legally. Mm. Even though, as I've said, not everything stands up in court, but there are very different ways of making music.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks. Then next, Neil Fraser, or Matt Professor, welcome. You are one of the most prominent dub music producers in the UK. Work collaborate with artists like Lee Scratch Perry, who we've seen before on the screen, and Massive Attack. And you run also the Arriva studio and label. And so you have like both an artist and label perspective in this. Maybe I ask you first from your artist, because we're talking about artists mostly. So your main instrument is the mixing desk.
Yes. Thank you first. Great to be here. Yes. My main instrument is rather unconventional. It's the mixing desk, and you know, because dub music is probably one of the most recent forms of musical inventions, and it's really one of the first remixes style, wherein we take an original song and we could remix that song first, strip it down, and we could even recreate other songs on the framework and on the chord structure based on the original song. So it's something that was developed in the 70s, started in Jamaica with a guy called King Tubbies, and people like Lee Scratch Perry, Errol Thompson, they took it further by really creating some very interesting songs, but in the old days it would have been questionable because those songs, a lot of times, they're based on other songs. And of course, things like this is a test for like traditional copyright laws, mm-hmm. which were started before this advent and this evolution, so to speak. So from an artist's point of view, because, you know, I mean, I don't sing, you know, and I don't really perform as a singer. So because I perform on the mixing desk, my point of view and my whole attitude to copyright is slightly different from the singer, you know. But I hear the cries and I understand the kind of lament that most people are facing now, especially with remixes, where a remixer could sample an original song and then he would call it his own. And if he's discovered, then he might say, okay, yeah, guilty. But if he's not discovered, then he goes away with a lollipop. So,
how do you do, like in your own practice, what do you use as input for your, like for your own releases that you bring out under your own name? What do you, because you need some input into the mixing desk. What do you use as, you know, source?
You mean the sound source?
Yeah.
Well, in our studios, when we record, we still use tape. We still use analog 2-inch tape in a conventional way. I've got a few Studer machines and MCI machines. But we also, because we need to talk to the rest of the world in a modern way, we use Pro Tools as well, you know, to like...
No, I meant the kind of, like, the music. Like, who makes the music that you put into the...
Right,
yeah.
Right, okay.
Not the technology.
Right. Okay, yeah. Now, I've got my team of musicians who... You know, and I mean, we do a lot of creating, creating of music in the studio as well. Okay. It's not just based on covers, but sometimes we could take a cover and create a whole new song based on like just the verse of that cover. You know, I mean, these days you're only limited by your imagination. You know, you could take two bass lines and combine it with another two bass lines, or, you know, I mean, you know, the sky's the limit, really. Hmm.
And do you, like, do the musicians that make the music, mm-hmm. are they participate, like, do the, you, they all, do you share the copyrights after?
Sometimes, sometimes. You know, the problem largely with music is that most musicians enter into music just wanting to be musicians, you know, play music. No one tells you that there's this whole big legal wrangling and, you know, legality position about songs. And most of us, either discover the legality when we're faced with a lawsuit or when we realize someone has plagiarized one of our songs, you know, because no one tells you, you know. And even as a label owner, sometimes I'm faced with artists who tell me, well, you know, I didn't realize that that my song was earning every time it got played on the radio, or I'm supposed to earn mechanical thing. But, you know, I have to point out that I too, when I started, because I just had this idea of starting a studio and a label. I mean, and when I started at the end of the 70s, there were no schools or no books or, you know, the whole communication wasn't like it is now, where you could Google and you could find things out. You know, you literally jump in, say, right, I'm going to make some music, I'm going to press some records. And then, well, actually my first experience of the legality is when I released a song with a girl in 81, a song called Love Power. And it got played on the radio Saturday night, and good response. And then I think on Monday, I had a call from someone with a very irate voice. I want to speak to the person who's responsible for this record. I said, oh, it's me. He said, where did you get that song from? I said, well, the girl brought it. She said, it's her song. He said, no, it's not. We did the song on a demo on Capital Radio a few months ago. So I said, oh, I didn't know that. So it appears the girl, the Venus Stone, she heard the song, liked the song, copied it, and I knew nothing about all this legality. So then he said, well, look, we've checked you out and realized you've just started, and, you know, but normally, you know, we'd really want to seek some damages because, you know, it's our copyright on this. So, you know, like, you know, a lot of people think labels know everything, but, you know, we all had to go down the road of learning and also remembering that the law changes every few years, and the law changes according to how the whole technology has, where it's going, you know? So, yeah, we're here to learn and to teach each other. We're not here to thief from each other.
Okay. Thank you. And then Helen Smith, you are executive chair of Impala, that is the Association of Independent Labels and their trade associations in Europe. So you're based in Brussels and deal with European politics, I think. So you're you have a perspective from the side of labels, and I'm interested, for one, like, what is like Impala's work regarding copyright at the moment, and what's important for the discussion in that context. And then also I'm interested to see like how you, like independent labels, major labels, like to see like a bit of a wider ecosystem, or and also the platforms that you are like situated in, so that we can get kind of a wider view of the whole system.
Okay, sure. So Impala represents independent labels, and that basically just means labels that are not part of or one of the majors. So that's the ecosystem outside Universal, Sony, Warner. Used to be more, but gradually over the years of consolidation, the number has reduced. And I think, you know, from our members' perspective, I think they kind of see this balance. You know, the title of the panel is copyright. It's about money and morals. And I think they would probably like to see themselves as some kind of balancing influence with those two priorities. They account for 80% of all new releases, and I think that certainly from our perspective, one of our jobs is to communicate that so that those who make decisions about what the framework looks like, they actually realise that those who are investing and working with artists and taking a risk are actually independent, which basically means like micro, small. I mean, there are even only a handful of medium-sized companies in the independent sector. And I think that can help inform them when they have to make decisions about copyright. You mentioned Europe and what's going on. There's a fundamental review going on now about copyright. So I think, you know, one of our jobs is to communicate that you know, this is not just about a big fight between big tech and major music companies.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see, like, do you have like numbers or like where the independent and major labels, like regarding like market share of like what the copyright mark with regards to copyright?
Sure. So it kind of varies country to country, obviously, and depends on which countries you have a strong local repertoire presence. But I think overall, it also depends on distribution, who your distribution statistics are with. But basically, you know, traditionally you would say that we would account for 80% of all new releases and 20% of the revenue. There are more statistics coming out now about if you look at ownership rather than distribution, then you're probably maybe between 30 to 40% mm-hmm. in terms of revenue. But clearly there is a big gap as regards the share of revenue compared to the share that you're actually contributing in terms of new music. So that this is like a really interesting statistic. And it's to do with power in the music market. We heard earlier, you know, about the dominance of a few small players who managed to capture all the key routes to market. So key spots on playlists, whether that's offline radio, whether it's playlists on streaming services. And you know, our job is to try and make sure those access routes are open. Mm-hmm. And that's why the framework, that's why regulation is interesting when you're in our member's position.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's for the round of introduction. Thank you. I think there were already like several points raised. I would like to start the discussion with a term that points to the first part of the title of this panel, Money and Morals. I would like to start discussing the term fairness. Because that term in discussions around copyright is always being raised, like in policy discussions, as well as I think in your academic work you have written about it. Fair, it's always being talked about fair remuneration for artists through the means of copyright, which sounds great. But what do people or the different stakeholders actually mean by fairness?
Yeah. Well, to me, fairness is when you share and you don't have any like regret or any kind of feelings that you're treating the people who you're sharing with in a bad way. And fairness, I think in songwriting ways is where everyone could partake in the earnings of a particular work, as opposed to say like in the old days some people would just be paid out a flat fee, like a one-off fee, and then the song could go on to earn millions, and they're thinking every time they hear that record, but that's me on this record, and I don't get anything. That is grossly unfair, you know. So fairness, there's a morality to it as well, wherein, you know, someone really should be credited both financially and otherwise for their works. You know.
Yeah, thank you. I looked actually at this use of fairness in a study about the current copyright reform, and what I found is that, which is also probably quite intuitive, that everybody has their own idea of fairness. And so, for instance, in the context of Article 13, people are, there's this idea that record labels don't think that it is fair that tech giants don't pay them. Musicians have a different view, which is more aligned with what Matt is saying. So everybody has their very different views of what fairness means, and it's interesting to see what then the Parliament or the European Union government does with it, mm-hmm. Which is very much inscribed in a sort of neoliberal worldview, mm-hmm. where entrepreneurship matters over employment, over sort of more socialist mm-hmm. processes. So, yeah, that's.
Yeah, I mean, we found quite a lot of, when you talk to musicians, particularly those who aren't making, as I say, large amounts of money from music, they do have a strong sense that fairness is important to the way in which they get treated. And their idea is that, you know, well, I haven't got much money. If I sample and I don't get a license, that's fair. You know, what rule is being broken? Who's being harmed? They talk about fairness in relation to other members of the band, as you were saying, about how you maintain a relationship where, you know, equal contributions. And they talk about the unfairness of the way in which people then take advantage of what they've done. It seems also interesting how, depending on the kind of music you make, you have a rather different idea of fairness. So jazz musicians take different ideas about fairness and the rights of creativity to classical musicians, who have a different view from folk musicians, who regard the, you know, most of the music they use as a kind of public resource, and it's fair. No one can claim ownership of it. It seems to me there's some very interesting different ideas of fairness, and of course we have those terms, fair dealing and fair use, that somehow define what we mean when we're doing music. But also you get really interesting debates about what's fair around, you know, the Blurred Line case, and I know that's being discussed tomorrow, so I won't go on it now, but it does seem to me you get two very interesting accounts of what is fair. On the one hand, it isn't fair that Robin Thicke and so forth get this huge fine, because actually the song isn't the same. Blurred Lines is not the same as the Marvin Gaye song. And on the other hand, you're saying, no, it isn't fair that they're profiting from a particular musical tradition which they did nothing to contribute to and which they're then benefiting from. And it does seem to me that sense of fairness runs throughout the way in which we debate about copyright and the ways in which we make judgments about whether it is doing the right thing for the people involved.
Helen, you also, I think, Impala also talks about fair pay.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
We've got a kind of concrete example, actually, quite recently in our community. What we started to see were new types of digital deals where remuneration wasn't just in terms of, you know, a fee for an item. You know, so you would find yourself in a situation where, as labels, you could negotiate, especially if you work collectively, as we have done over the past 10 years in our sector, you would be in the same situation as, say, the majors, where you could negotiate minimum guarantees, big advances, equity. And in our sector, decided that we had to be very clear that that was also counted as remuneration, and you had to basically pay that on to your artists, even if you couldn't necessarily identify a particular payment with a particular use. So you'd have to work out how you would administer it. And that was something which was called the Fair Digital Deals Declaration, and that was adopted at international level. And you know, we were particularly pleased with the European result, because two-thirds of the original signatories were European, and we felt that was like a really strong message about how our community feels about what fairness means. I think, you know, certainly from our label's perspective, you know, they'll say that they have never been before been as so inundated with requests from artists who want to work with labels, who really want to find professional partners, but they all have different ideas about what's fair. So, you know, often more established artists will want to retain more control over their rights, so maybe they'll just look to you for a distribution deal, or maybe they'll want to do a profit share. Maybe some younger artists are just interested in maybe a big advance initially because they need to have that cash up front. So maybe they would prefer a higher advance, maybe a lower royalty. We've even had discussions at Impala about, you know, what's fair and you know, the even in Europe, you have so many different ideas. So one country will say, oh, this is fair, and another country will say, oh, my God, I'm, don't publish that because that's embarrassingly low. And then you have another situation in France where certain things are paid for by the label, which means they pay a lower royalty rate. So like Europe is very diverse, the approaches to fairness are similarly very diverse, and I think what's happening with the directive is that they're now looking, particularly with the version that's just been discussed in Parliament, about whether they can at least adopt a notion of fairness and then sort of leave it afterwards to work out what that actually means. But at least the notion would be there that, yeah, artists and performers and authors need to be paid something which is fair, whatever that means.
Yeah. Yeah, because fair is just, what does it relate to, actually? Like, what's, like, other people's income or what, like, a platform makes or what a major artist makes? Like, it's very vague, no? So maybe we can become a bit more concrete on, so we talked about, like, a lot around copyright is being discussed on the moral kind of aspect. But when, if we talk about payments and think about what copyright can do for artists, how do you see this? Like, which artists which artists benefit from copyright? You already said the authors more than the performers, but are there any other differences among artists? How they benefit, like regarding popularity, for example, or regarding what kind of music they make, or do you see anything there?
The music industry, the structure of the market is something called winner take all, which is basically that there's very few people who get a lot of the money, and a lot of people who get very little. And so there isn't really very much in between. It's like 80% go to 1% and the rest goes to everybody else. And that can be composers or performers or just superstars who happen to be.
And how does that happen? They can just negotiate better contracts or conditions, or what's the main reason for that?
The main reason.
I don't know. I think it's also to do with the marketing and promotion. Yeah. You know, you have you know, big corporations that are putting a lot of marketing money behind certain types of big international acts. But I think the statistics on independent labels are a little bit more interesting, because, you know, some labels will say that they can't afford to make a loss, so they will maybe start with a lower budget, and they try to make money for the label and for the artist on 90% of their releases by just having a different approach to what they see as the appropriate level of scale. But certainly, you know, I think that has to be a factor in why, you know, so much of the revenue is going to so few.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I think that most labels, they would have a bigger interest in investing in promotion when they have a bigger stake you know, because like anyone else, no one wants to work. Put it this way, if a label is only getting 10% of the remuneration of a record earnings, and the artist is getting 90%, he isn't gonna work so hard. You know, they would just sit back and let it happen. But if the label is getting like 50%, then straight away they're more interested in the whole thing working and getting it promoted, making sure the artists earn. And I think that's where the whole difference comes into it, you know. There is people out there who would promote heavy, but, you know, and they've got the contacts, they've got the means, you know, they could put you on all the festivals, but if they're only getting 5% or 1%, then why? They would rather find an artist and do a deal where they could get a larger slice of the pie. Simple as that. It's economics.
I mean, I think there is a really interesting kind of case study of this attempt to see how it is artists and labels should work together with Rough Trade in the sort of early 1980s, where they devise a contract in which they say to their artists, you know, we're not going to sign you for multiple album deals, we're just it's a one album deal at a time, and we will share, once the costs have been written off, we will share royalties equally with you. And it, you know, and it was written on a kind of, you know, a napkin or just a back of a beer coaster or something. It was that kind of informal sense that the principles of democracy should determine how musicians and record labels should work together. Intuitively you think, well, that's right, that's exactly how it should possibly be. But of course, for Rough Trade, it was the beginning of the end, because artists who, as soon as they became successful, realized they could go elsewhere just at the drop of a hat and get massive budgets to support marketing and recording and so forth, and Rough Trade were left without a roster of artists or resources to build up the next act. So, you know, that seems to me a really interesting and rather sad case of what happens when you try to implement what you might call democratic principles in order to reward all parties to the deal.
With a view on time, I would like to go to the next question. looking a bit at the overall ecosystem that artists create in, and thinking about so copyright, the idea is that an artist is incentivized to create through making money and also being kind of that the work is being protected. So I'm wondering what else is important for artists to create, like looking at this one specific point I wanted to pick up also from the conversation, from the discussion before, just because it's being currently debated so much at the EU level concerning the new EU directive. And this is the whole topic of user-generated content and the platforms that Aram was talking about in his talk before. Because in the current discussion, there's like the debate, just briefly for those who haven't been following that, that all, so one position, and I think also what Impala is trying to achieve, is that the platforms like YouTube, as a major example, should be liable like for all copyright infringements, and therefore be forced to license the entire, you know, what they are hosting. And then there are people, like, on the other hand, who are concerned, or there are like some concerns that this would be like at the expense of like digital cultural practice, because those platforms would be incentivized like not to do user-generated content, basically, and be all be like kind of a Spotify, Netflix kind of model, or they couldn't be afford this anymore, or to establish like automated filtering just to avoid liability. And I'm curious in your view, how do you see this type of like use those spaces where, you know, music like those SoundCloud type of spaces or YouTube where music is being like shared and also remixed and used and not maybe not only by kind of the professional artists but also maybe those that are tomorrow's artists like teenagers today. What is your view on those kind of spaces for the overall ecosystem of an artist?
Well, I don't believe too much in having these YouTubes and SoundClouds for free, you know, where people could just listen and download stuff. I think that's wrong, probably because I'm coming from an era when you couldn't do that, you know. But I think a lot of younger people who are keen on promoting their stuff seem to think that's the way forward, to be available on every free facility going on the internet and things. But I think at the end of the day, the audience have less respect for music when it's just free, and they value it more when they have to pay for it. I mean, in the old days, we would seek down a track, and of course, you could only hear that track if you either go to a club or if you buy the record, and you would seek it down, even if you have to pay like £30, £100 for that track. Now, you know, most tracks are available. You put it on your computer, and when you're tired of it, you wipe it off, you delete it. So, you know, there's less respect right now for music because it's too available. You know?
So Impala's perspective is informed by, you know, our members across different countries, and we have so many different views on this question. You know, we have classical labels who think that Spotify is just a total nightmare because it's paid on a play basis, not on a time basis. They think the quality is awful. We have other labels who have, you know, fantastic YouTube channels who really have totally embraced the model. And I think our perspective is one that, okay, so if you want to participate, then that's great. And if you don't, then that's also fine. But you should be able to choose. So it's really a question of freedom of choice for artists and for labels, and whether they have that freedom today. And the question about the copyright reform and Article 13 is interesting, because, you know, in Impala's world, we actually licensed Napster, which was one of the logos you saw earlier, and we actually licensed Napster when it was the world's second most recognized brand. There was only one brand that was more recognized than Napster at that particular time, and that was Coke. And you know, here we are, you know, so much further down the line. And from our members' perspective, you know, Article 13 is about bringing some balance. It's about platforms that make money from music and other content, and it's about making sure that, you know, there is an obligation to share that. It's really as simple as that, and that means licensing and putting in place certain measures that will allow you to be able to get some money and share it with your artist, basically. That's as simple as that, from my perspective anyway.
But then there's also another view, which is more or less what Aram was describing previously, which is you put a lot of machines to check what comes up, and then machines don't filter whether it's a parody or it's a remix or it's a use that is normally framed within fair use, and you stop what some campaigners have called, they are in fact censorship machines. And so the problem with that is that even if you put people there to check what is right and what can go as fair use, you give an incredibly amount of power to the music industry to decide what can go online. And it's been really quite amazing how there's been an unprecedented support from scholars resisting this. So it's not as simple as you get paid. If we have Article 13, then record labels get paid. It has social consequences and consequences for the internet. And while I share Helen's preoccupations or concerns, I don't think Article 13 is the solution. And I'd like to hear from you what you think about the issues Aram raised, or highlighted.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, obviously, from our members' perspective, it's all about balance. And the beauty of platforms like YouTube is that it takes the headache of licensing and responsibility away from music fans and citizens. Because at the moment, what's happening is platforms are saying, it's not my responsibility, it's the citizen's responsibility. And we just think that's not on, that's not fair. So the idea of this is to bring the level of responsibility where it should be, which is with the platforms that are making money. As to the questions about filtering, we know that certain businesses are very good at making, you know, their commercial interests appear aligned to those of citizens. And we have seen a lot of lobbying, and we've seen a huge amount of pressure based around that notion. So citizens are led to believe that they share the same interests as YouTube. And, you know, clearly, I don't think that's quite the whole story. You know, from our perspective, there has to be a balance, and it's about, you know, being able to identify in the same way as radio and other models. You know, they will identify what's being used. It's about identifying what's being used with those who own it and those who've created, so that they can be remunerated. I mean, our artists, you know, hardly any artists, I don't know about yours, but hardly any artists today are saying, you know, can you take this down? I don't want it to be on YouTube. They're saying, how much are you getting? Are you getting the same as Sony? Are you getting the same as Universal? It's like a totally different world. It's not about prohibition. It's not about controlling and filtering. It's about identification and liberating a system that works really well. Mm. That's how it was.
I think also probably like most people would agree on the kind of licensing, like real tracks, like that are full track. I think like all of the gray areas come in when there is some people using snippets of things, and where maybe regulations like other type, like allowing some type of fair use, would need to be part of the conversation, I guess. But I mean, this was just also to bring in like the, to show that it's like a current, like there's stuff that is being currently discussed also for those who are not participating in that so much. I think the time is running quickly. Maybe to round off, like maybe how, if we're thinking about the role of copyright for artists, how important, like now this is just, you know, very as the question of fair, like how important do you find it? And maybe one question I have also for John, because you have interviewed so many artists, is there maybe how is like the generational difference? Neil, you said you're coming from a time where you had to buy things. That's what informs your opinion. Did you find a difference in like the generations with a view to?
We found a difference depending on how much money you were making. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that was the really important determinant in how much people knew about copyright. And it is, as you described it, that people learned about copyright when they had to, but, you know, they could have all the lessons you like at school, but it wasn't going to go in. I think the only thing I would just add to the discussion in terms of how we think about copyright in the future and so forth, one of the things that came across very much in our interviews with professional musicians was how they, you know, how we fail to acknowledge the importance of copying. I mean, Aaron made that point early on in his talk, but it did seem to me that music is made by copying, and creativity is often kind of given this exclusive platform, which it doesn't really warrant. And actually, creativity and copying are so closely linked to each other, and that copyright can sometimes get in the way of the way in which music actually gets made, which is through learning songs from other people and then varying it and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that's an important part of what copyright policy ought to acknowledge more than it does, this fact that copying is part of how you learn to play music and how you create music.
I like to say that copyright is important for the commercial aspects of music, and it helps to generate a lot of money, but I don't think that copyright acts as an incentive to the creation of music. And as I just said, the market structure is a winner-takes-all. That means that there's a lot of people producing without getting any money at all. So I don't think it is necessary for creation, or if copyright doesn't exist, then creativity will go away, or things that you read and hear sometimes being rehearsed by powerful bodies. But yes, it helps to organize a market.
Yes, well, I think copyright is really necessary to ensure there is some system in place for those who are aware. Unfortunately, not everybody is aware of their rights. And like I said before, the rights keep changing and the market share keeps changing. And as you pointed out, even the styles of music, it varies, because like the discipline probably among classical musicians is certainly way different from the discipline of street musicians with more of an urban feel, with more of a street feel, like hip hop and rap and dub and reggae is certainly more, like a free for all. And who knows, and who don't know, that's too bad, So it's a little bit unfair in that sense.
From our perspective, copyright is essential, because otherwise those who create are basically slaves to those who want to exploit. And that could be a label, it could be a publisher. For labels and publishers, it's those who want to make money from advertising or whatever they want to do with music without sharing it. So, copyright is the essential tool. We see it as a liberator. The question is whether those who have copyright can become too big, and then they start to distort the power that copyright gives you. So I would say look at the market, and look at the power, and look at the size of operators, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater by thinking that copyright is a devil, because I think that's the wrong way to look at it.
We have not touched on the topic, but that Aaron did that before, that also musicians like use copyrighted work, like this, are not only like selling their product but also using, which puts them maybe in a different position and interest point than a label, for example. But we want to have some time for discussion. There are like maybe two questions or so we can take at this at this time.
Hi, thank you for your perspectives. I think to bring into this conversation, maybe it's important to think about how the digital culture is so radically transforming how we share together and think together, that whether you're on the side of copyright or copyleft, we have to think about how to rein in these massive companies that now have so much power over our intellectual capacities and production and sharing things. And so rather than getting into these legal aspects, do you think of ownership or copyleft, is it maybe some strategies to go about like breaking up these monopolies of communication channels? It's a whole new territory somehow that we need to really think of how to attack them and reclaim what is, you know, the culture that's happening. That, you know, you take an example of Amazon, you know, destroying small bookshops and things like that because they just, their strategy is to be the giant monopoly. So I don't know if you could feedback on that and think about what could our strategies be just against the corporate monoliths.
Shall I take that one? Because that's something that's something Impala's done quite a lot of work on. You know, we talk about rewriting the rules of engagement online, and you know, what the question would be from your perspective, is that enough, or do we need to actually think about dismantling certain monopolies in exactly the same way as has been done in other fundamental sectors, all the amenities, electricity, transport, water, all those essential facilities have been totally broken up in other sectors. And the question is, have we got to that stage in the digital world? And certainly quite a few parliamentarians in the European Parliament believe that we have got to that stage with certain operators, and particularly when they start to occupy and monopolize, you know, vertically integrated parts of the network. So search, sharing, data, you know, all everything that anybody uploads, the copyright of that is owned by the platform, and they can do whatever they like. You won't get any money from it. And you don't even have the rights over your data in terms of privacy. These are the big questions for Europe and also for national governments. And I would say yes, there is a case for dismantling operators. Yeah.
I mean, I would just add. I mean, in a sense, it's Aaron's story again. Is at the moment we've got Tidal, we've got, you know, we've got Spotify, but in 5-10 years' time, will we have those competing services, or will we just have the one? And I have to say, as a member of that Brexit nation, the EU seems to be the only power that is actually taking on these kinds of organisations. And I wish.
And that's next year's discussion. Or in 2 years.
Okay, so I'll try to phrase my question as quickly as possible, so if I get too much into detail, you can shout or something to stop, but I'll try to go into a question about definition, which was posed by Ms. Aguilar, about what it means to be an author versus a performer, and you said something along the lines of that an author is the composer of the score, right? So I personally don't know exactly how a score is defined in legal terms, but I thought, so if the score is just based in, it's a very naive way of seeing it maybe, but if the score is just notes or something like that on a piece of paper, and the notes can be the same for many songs, so how is it legally defined what a score is without regarding the output, like the timbre of the music, the quality, the envelope, the nuances of the performer? I mean, is it like a, like, because the whole work of art would be performer plus author, right? So I'm a bit confused about that. I don't know if I made the question clear enough.
Yeah, you did make it clear. In order for copyright to subsist in a work of music, it needs to be fixed. It needs to be fixed somehow. It's not enough to just have an idea, but you have to fix it on either a piece of paper or recording or whatever technology there is. And then it starts happening. But because it all started with the score, those are the elements that are in the score are the ones that became privileged. So the things you're talking about, like timbre and envelope and all these things and dynamics that are not on this score, are not really important to copyright law. Yeah? So because of recording technology, there are other ways of composing, and that's where something like Nashville style makes sense, because you can have several people doing a lot of these things, like producers and or traditional producers or and singers and instrumentalists and composers or whatever, being authors as well, if you fix it in a different way. Does that make sense? Does that answer? Yeah, and it's a bit also what Aaron was saying about, it's about social ideas of what authorship is and how that is linked to law and technology, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, it is a very broad discussion.
Yeah, could I just add, in our world of music, we have the composer down as the person who creates the music, largely, and the melodies, and the author is normally the person who supply the words. And somehow, marriage together, these two make the song. You know, maybe it's wrong, but that's how for years we break down the thing into composer, melody, music, author, words. Simple.
Do we have to wrap up? Yeah. We have to wrap up. Well, thank you very much. I think there is much more to discuss, and maybe we can do this after, during the DJ sets later on or so. Thank you all for this conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.